And welcome to the Glacially Musical Podcast. It is beer, metal, and swearing. I am now using my brand new radio voice. Of course, I am Nick Cameron, joined by my good friend, a man who's always swimming, looking in the crags, under the water, trying to find it all, Keefe Cousteau. How are we doing today?
Ha ha! Keefe Cousteau is here with the shark! Ha ha ha!
I know that accent is a complete insult to everyone that is French, and I am deeply sorry, but also it's funny.
I'm not sorry. I'm sorry I'm not sorry. I wish I could be, because that is very insensitive. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week. If you are here, of course, the meat of the episode is Slayer, Rain and Blood, R.I.B. Is it wrong that I noticed that it's an anagram for rib? Not anagram, it is an acronym, Rain and Blood, rib. And I imagine Slayer's eating a lot of bone-in ribeyes. I just got to mention steak. I'm not having any this week, so I got to mention it.
I think it's both an anagram and an acronym, no? It's ribs. Ribs.
I don't think it's... No. An anagram is when you take the letters of a word to make it spell something else.
Oh, well, I mean rib.
That's acronym. When you take the letters of an abbreviation to spell a word, like scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. What? So anybody here who is here for the English lessons, you may now tune out because we are over. If you are here for Slayer's third full-length album, if you want to call it that, it is debatable. Rain and Blood, thank you very much. If you have been here the entire time, you should have carved Slayer into your arm in the first week and put Neosporin on your arm in the second week in order to get rid of the infection that you most certainly acquired. Because and a tetanus shot, probably. Anyway, here is how we do this if you are just here for the first Slayer episode, Rain and Blood. We do a greeting, an announcement of what we are doing, beer check, vinyl check, shirt check, news check, meat of the day. Meat of the day is Slayer's bone-in cowboy tomahawk ribeye. Beer of the week from one of my absolute favorite breweries, Schlafly Brewing in downtown St. Louis, Missouri. The Schlafly Scotch Ale. It has been years since they have brewed this beer, and I saw Randall's, the number one liquor store in St. Louis that I took you to get our beer for the weekend. They sent me an email saying, "But we got Scotch Ale." And I said, I'll be there in a minute, honey. Finger fudge pour. Drinking out of my St. Louis, well, not St. Louis, my Football Hall of Fame actual pint glass. It actually holds a pint.
That is impressive as shit. That's a good pour. I am not drinking any beer because I am sober right now. So instead, I'm having another liquid death.
Murder your thirst.
Murder your thirst with this beautiful severed lime in a green can. And I am going to pour it into a glass because I'm not a heathen today. I have my Lost Coast Brewing glass. I haven't drank out of this in quite a while. And, you know, it's the finger fudge pour that doesn't count because it's seltzer and not beer. But, seltzer has gas too. So a beautiful pour because it's not a beer. Cheers.
Cheers, my friend. YouTube happy hour. Now, if you don't mind, I will start the vinyl check this week. I believe I usually do, however, so I don't know why I'm saying that. I have got to start clearing out some room in the brand new ready-to-be-checked shelf because I have been gorging at the trough like one of the pigs and spirited away on new vinyl. Not new, new to me. The first one up is previous podcast subject, Iron Maiden. I finally picked up an OG copy of Power Slave. This was from a seller on Discogs, already in the Mylar. This is not a collector's copy, as it does not have the inners. It's just the sleeve and the record. And honestly, it might even be a Frankenstein. I don't know if it's the correct sleeve to. It's the sleeve is kind of embossed-ish, which I had never touched this on vinyl before. I think I got it for about $20 shipped, which is, I thought, a pretty reasonable price for something so cool. Next, I was driving home, and a song from my youth came on the radio. And that song was Insane in the Brain. And I thought to myself, you know what I don't have? You know what I do have now? Cypress Hill, Black Sunday. It is a nine. It's already, I'm buying outer sleeves finally. So you can tell how long I've had these because if they're in the outer sleeves or not. But it is a nice two-disc set as not to squishify the tracks. And I got this one. Now this one, I'm going to say I splurged on this one. On Amazon, this sucker was $38. The same day I bought my wife a record that was also $38. And I don't remember what that was. But she said she wanted it, so I bought it.
I believe... And, oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I believe we had said in the past that a solid amount of money for a 2LP record was $35 to $40.
But I don't consider this to be a 2LP record. If it's not over 60 minutes, it's just a 90s record. And 90s records, for some reason, were 45 to 60 minutes of the time.
Yeah, that's tracks completely on something I just saw. I don't know if our listeners are also watchers of the Rick Beato channel on YouTube, but Rick Beato just did a break. You know, he always does these, like, let's analyze the Spotify top 10. And it's always music he hates because it's pop and rap and reggaeton and things. But he was analyzing trends. And he said, like, pop music in the 50s, 60s, 2-minute songs, 3-minute songs. Pop music in the 70s, 80s, 90s, longer, 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 5 to 6 minutes in the 90s in the grunge era. 2000s to now, shorter, shorter, shorter. Just interesting. By the way, Power Slave, my favorite Iron Maiden record. Black Sunday, inarguably the best Cypress Hill record, although I love the first one.
I didn't know that it was not the first one.
Oh, no, the original self-titled Cypress Hill record has sawed-off shotgun, hand on the pump. That song's on that. There's a couple of bangers on that first one. It's pretty much the starter, the rookie version of Black Sunday. It's like all the elements are there. Mugs, DJ, great raps, Sendog, great voice, Chuck D voice, except West Coast.
Sendog is one of my favorite just... rappers of all time.
He's incredible live, by the way. If you've ever seen Cypress Hill live.
I have not.
I've been lucky enough to see them a few times, including Woodstock 94. Two great pickups by you, man. That is sensational.
Oh, I got one more. I got one more this week.
A threefer. Okay.
The last one, it's also a band we've discussed on the podcast. However, we have not done a series on them. And when we saw Metallica and I saw Pantera's, you know, tribute or whatever you want to call it, I remembered, my God, how much I love Pantera and how much I really wish I had Pantera, Vulgar Display of Power. Again, this is a re-release gatefold. It is a two-disc set as well. This one, I think I spent $25 on. I'm going to get this down because the insert noises are making bad noises, so I yield my time.
Well, I usually unfurl my, unless it's an unboxing video for us, I usually unfurl my LP behind me first, and I just pull it out in pieces. But I understand. I don't mind the ASMR. I think people dig it. Consider this. The most popular stuff on YouTube is people eating food and reviewing it. And it's like, is anybody... like excited to hear
stop chomp. That
like
that
it's
is,
gross
that is my personal hell.
Yeah By the way, as we're recording this on the next to last day of February, Vulgar Display of Power turned 30 years old on February 25th. It is also my favorite Pantera record. You have three of my favorite records of all
it
time.
It is everybody's favorite Pantera
record. It is
record,
not everybody. No,
unless you're wrong. No.
Yes, but also a lot of people prefer Far Beyond Driven, and more people even than that, the guitar nerds, continue to like uphold Cowboys from Hell because it's like 80,000 tracks of guitar in every song, which, by the way, more guitar tracks usually makes a thing sound thinner, but the old conventional wisdom of before digital recording, when everything was on 2-inch tape, more tracks makes it like Queen. Wrong. Only Roy Thomas Baker was able to do that, and a few other people, Glenn Johns, Eddie Kraber, not everybody. Usually many tracks makes a thing sound thinner in the mastering.
It makes it sound wrong, and I've always been a big proponent of the live show, the live album, and all that. In fact, we have 12 concerts we have paid to go to this year already, and Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan was just announced, so we're probably buying tickets to that, and we're fighting back and forth if we're going to go see Manson and Cooper. I don't know if we've decided if we're going to go...
Not Manson. Rob Zombie and Cooper.
Oh.
Manson is canceled.
That's right.
He's probably not ever coming back to a touring... He's threatening new music, but he's probably canceled.
You're right. You're right. I apologize. It used to be Zombie and Manson. I apologize. It's Zombie and Cooper.
Cooper and Manson have also done a co-headline tour also.
Yeah, I saw that too.
I want to tell you that I saw last year the exact same tour, and I loved it. And I will tell you, Cooper owned Zombie, but that's because Cooper has great songs. Like 8 of his 10, 11 songs are fantastic. And Zombie has 2 songs and a bunch of crap.
He has Dragula and Thunderkiss 65.
I would say also Living Dead Girl's a bop, but the rest forgettable. Sometimes he does Supercharger Heaven. Sometimes.
He's like Ministry. If Ministry were really, really bad instead of just boring.
Oh, Ministry is the opener on that tour, as well as Filter, who is fantastic, by the way.
Oh, that's right. You know what? I don't know that I want to go anymore.
Oh, brutal. You should see Coop, man. He's not going to be doing this much longer.
I have lost count.
Oh, what about the wife, though? Lawyer wife.
We have lost count.
Oh, then forget it. You've seen it. Nothing new under the sun there.
No, I saw Cooper the first time in Six Flags. He was touring Brutal Planet 2, I believe, when he was doing a haunted house.
I have the vinyl
Six
somewhere.
Flags locations. Do you? I do not. I don't have any of his moderner stuff.
Of it's not bad.
Then I saw him open up for Heaven and Hell, a.k.a. Dio Sabbath Reunion. Lawyer Wife and I saw him with Hailstorm. We walked out early on that one. That was the Deep Cuts tour. I mean, when I say early, he was playing 20 tracks that show, and I think we stayed for 13 or 14. It wasn't like, you know, it's... And we're just not super fans. We're not aficionados of Alice Cooper. When people talk about the casual fans, yeah, that's me and Alice Cooper. I've got about 15 of his records, and I don't know any of them. And saw him with Crew. And I know... Oh, and we saw him with Manson. So Lawyer Wife and I have at least seen him at least three times.
Then you don't have to go. Like, if you've never seen Cooper, I tell people to go.
Yes,
because even in a co-headline show, you're still getting the essence of a great Cooper set. I do want to tell you that every time I have seen Alice co-headline, every time he has upstaged the partner band.
Every time I have seen him co-headline and open sometimes, because I don't want to admit this, so I'm going to whisper it. He kind of upstaged Black Sabbath with Dio because he was way more energetic than they were.
Dio might have had cancer at that time. We don't know.
It was 07. So, yeah, I guess we don't know when it started.
We really don't know. We do know because we both read the book, but yeah, it was about that time. Yeah. To bring forth the rhythm and the rhyme. I have a 1-4 today if you're done with your vinyl check. Let's move this forward.
Yes, yep.
Also, Ministry new album this week. Ministry tour just kicked off with Gary Numan and Frontline Assembly, and I had to miss the opening date last night in San Francisco. It was sold out completely. I was a little bummed.
Happy Ministry album and tour for those who choose to celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. I may be doing a review of this on the Ghost Skull channels. So, my 1-4 today is an album by an artist I totally love, and not nearly as legendary yet as the ones you checked, but pretty killer. Perhaps you are familiar with the electro dance industrial artist Kanga.
No.
And her album Underglass, which came out on Artifact Records, a very fine record label that has Cloud Rat and Kylan Mikla and other bands we love here at the Glacially Musical Podcast and Ghost Cult Mag. I love Kanga. I saw her open for My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult last year. She is terrific.
That tour came to town, and I didn't go. I'm not a fan, but that tour did come.
They're an acquired taste. This is her new album in the beautiful orange. Here's the back cover. She's wearing this sort of spangly, barely a top.
I was going to mention that.
One of her fun things is that she sells her stage-worn clothes at the merch booth. So if you really want to smell what she smells like under the hot lights, you can buy her corsets and... booty shorts.
As someone who has purchased game-worn jerseys literally off the backs of players, ew.
Yeah, I think ill. But she's great, and I think she's very attractive. Great singer. Basically a solo one-woman, one-they-them dance artist. Laptop, turntable, mixers, effects, and a microphone. And she sings, and she'll rap, and she screams, and she play her beats and live play keyboards, sometimes live keyboard solo, live sound effects. Fantastic. And this, so that deep orange, the burnt sienna, one of my favorite colors of all time in the Pantone color book. The opposite color on the color wheel for that kind of orange is this gorgeous. Look at this blue. Oh my gosh.
That is a beautiful, beautiful translucent sky blue.
Officially a see-through blue. I will tell you that this was quite a pretty penny because Artifact Records doesn't have a distribution in America, so you're buying a record and shipping from Europe, which
you need to find somebody that be your European dump artist. Because I actually got a Dunkin' package coming pretty soon, and you can always tell on my PayPal when I've got a Dunkin' package going, because there's like 6 or 7 charges in a row that are all in pounds.
Haha, that's funny. Yeah, I mean Dunkin', you know, I don't want to. You're already utilizing the guy. I don't want to bother him. And even though he technically works for me. But it's okay. Already in the Mylar, already in the outer sleeve, ready to rock. And I played this. I love it. Part and parcel of the vinyl check, just one last thing before you shirt check and news check quickly. You know, there was a study last year. We discussed this at length several times on the podcast, that 50% of all vinyl purchasers do not own a turntable and never play their records. I don't want to be gatekeepery or snobby. It's just not everybody can do it, right? Listen, we're talking about an expense. The records are expensive. A turntable is expensive. A setup is expensive. Not everybody can put it together. A lot of people are so into the gamification of life, the Internet of Things, that they need something. If it's not plug and play, it's mind-blowing. They can't handle it. Even with the University of YouTube helping them. So I put up a sort of a meme, the equivalent of a meme, but it was really a question to our fans on Instagram. And I tagged Glacially Musical and linked our podcast link in the description.
I saw that. I didn't answer because you know my answer.
I know your answer, but an answer would have been nice. I tagged you on purpose.
I need
it was to promote this show.
Sorry, I need to be more active on Instagram instead of just posting a photo and throwing a couple.
If you love vinyl, listen to our show. Literally is the last thing in the thing. But, you know, on the plus side, I love that people are like, I don't have a turntable, but I will spend $50 at a show, because you know the markup is real because of merch cuts. So you know you're saving on shipping, but you're absolutely spending more money on vinyl at a show, going right into the artist's hands except for the merch cut. And I like that that's a thing, that some fans out there don't have a turntable and they buy vinyl. But you feel, on the other hand, this podcast is about vinyl love and celebration. So it's kind of hard.
When I say poor bastards, I'm not like making fun of them. I'm saying they don't know the joy of it. And they are poor in that way. They're not rich with vinyl love. I love that they are out there supporting the bands. That is, you know, I don't go, you know, arena shows are one thing, you know, and large theater shows are one thing as well. But every single club show I go to, if I like what you've done, I'm walking up and I'm buying something. I mean, I have a Toasters record. I have an Orange Tree record, and I had never heard of Orange Tree the day before that day, but they were a great local ska band, apparently, back in the day, Friends of the Urge. And I bought their record, and also it's Orange, which is kind of neat. And the name of the album is Can't Fix Stupid, which I appreciate. I am lucky enough, you know, I don't know if anybody remembers, but I mean, I have gone over what my personal system is, and I have problems getting some of my upgrades working. So I am actually going to be taking my turntable into a shop to have them upgrade my head shell and cartridge, because I have not been able to get it adjusted properly. When it works right, though, it sounds so much better. But in order to hear the difference between a vinyl and a CD and all that business, one, you've got to make sure you have the right record, because not all records are better. Records go from just as good as a CD up to, oh my God, the CD sounds like nothing I've ever heard, and it's a different song now, which is rare. I mean, it's rare to be that good. But to hear that, you have got to have, I mean, my receiver, if you were to go buy one now, would be about $300. My turntable to go buy one would be about $300 because I have vintage, very vintage stuff. My receiver is from 1971. My turntable is from 1975. And I have a pair of Sansui speakers, which would also run you $300, probably each at this point, that I got for $30 at a garage sale. So my receiver and my turntable were both gifted to me. So in order to have my setup, you've got to basically have $1,000. And that's a lot of money. I get that. And my kids got a pretty good setup. But again, it was all hand-me-down stuff. After my father-in-law died, we found a receiver. She has that receiver. She uses his turntable that I kept as a spare. And she's got a pair of shitty speakers. I keep trying to get her to upgrade them, but she just doesn't care. And that's the thing. She likes vinyl, not for the sound, but for the tactile pleasure. And I'm supporting the bands for her.
Because you know how she's 13. Rare that is, though? Like, she came along like she should be a Spotify kid. Your kid is exceptional. Again, I hate
she most is a Spotify children. Kid.
I hate most children, and I would drown them if they were mine. But your kid is wonderful. Really wonderful. Really an exceptional human being already. So I can only imagine in the future how terrific a person she's going to become in the future. But like,
Unfortunately, we're knee deep in teenage apathy. I didn't think we were going to get it right at 13, but we did.
No, right at 13. Welcome to the chapter one of the rest of your hell.
Yeah. Anyway, shirt
check. Ergo, I have no kids for that reason. Go ahead, Nick.
Shirt check. Friend of the show, Gravehuffer. Actually, have been missing this shirt. This shirt has been missing for a year and a half. It was found the other night. And told lawyer wife, you're lucky, because like you're lucky I'm not going to wear this shirt when we go out tonight because I need to save it for Wednesday.
And it was like clean folded somewhere? It wasn't like mildewy in a corner?
It wasn't mildewy, but it got washed. It was in a hamper somewhere. I mean, it's fine. Oh, okay. Look at it. It's fine.
That's dope,
It probably even still glows in the dark.
Richie's great. Hi, Richie Randall. Hi, Richie.
Yeah, unfortunately, now I'm not going to buy a new shirt, Richie, unless you come to town. I have been harassing him. They'll play like all over the Midwest, but never here.
Well, I mean, you know, if you overplay your home places, then people don't come see you.
No, he never plays here.
Okay, never.
Never. Yeah. He lives in Joplin. That's where Gravehuffer's based out of, and I've never seen them.
Okay.
I want to.
All right. Fair enough. I have a brand new shirt. I rarely check a brand new shirt. I've been checking the hits. Brand new shirt today. Look at this. Like, stand back and marvel at the greatness of this. Look at this. This is Doggo, or Dog, like Sun, the band. The Grimbork Demos. This is an incredible shirt that was really technically bought for charity on the last Bandcamp Friday. The next Bandcamp Friday is, as you listen to this, today on Friday, March 1st. And it was co-designed by Barry Ann from Fiada Productions. I hope I said that correctly. It's kind of a Gaelic word. I'm not good on pronunciations. And an artist named Matthew Mullen. And they collabed on this shirt. It's beautiful. It's comfortable. It's beautifully printed. Look how funny this is. Come on. If you're a metal fan and you love animals, Fiada Productions specializes in black metal, folk metal, doom metal, and it's all anti-fascist, anti-racist, and most of their proceeds outside of the production is all cassettes and digital, and most of the proceeds, almost all the proceeds actually, go to animal welfare, animal no-kill shelters, things like that. Incredible, incredible things. So I'm glad to support, and I got this hilarious shirt that I can now enjoy.
It is hilarious. Unfortunately, it's two things I don't like, which are dogs and crossover shirts. I don't know what it is. Crossover shirts do not work for me.
I am truly a cat person. I have had cats most of my adult life, including two very long-lived good girls that have passed over the Rainbow Bridge to Cat Valhalla, where hopefully they're playing with dead mice, batting them back and forth on their clouds. But not a bit. I have known some lovely dogs, but I'm not like the biggest dog person like some people. But also, I'm all about the dog rescue and the cat rescue.
I'm all about the rescue, but I am anti-dog for myself. due to childhood trauma.
I understand. Shit happens.
We had a dog that actually would chase me down and attack me at the age of 3 or 4. And
fuck.
Yeah, the way I always tell it is he ripped my pajamas while I wore them. Which is terrifying when that's in your bedroom.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Forget the boogeyman under the bed. It's the dog in real life.
Yeah, that dog actually was put down because nobody could get him under control.
Oh, that's horrible. I didn't want to hear that. Welcome to Nick's trauma session. Jesus.
I'm sorry.
And on that note, on to the metal news. Jesus.
All right. I have some good news. I got two news stories. I'm going to go quick on the first one. First one is Def Leppard is releasing the 40th anniversary of Pyromania. So happy 40th anniversary, deluxe box set day, Pyromania to all who choose to celebrate. I'm not with you. I have my original pressing of the record that I got for $1. A number of years ago now, when it was still lawyer girlfriend. So we've had that for a number of years. Got it for $1 at Record Exchange. Still has the $1 sticker on it. It's missing the inners and I don't care. Sounds fine. It's a 5-disc set. It's got all some half speed mastering. It's got vinyl set, there's a CD set, books, and blah, blah, blah. I am not a deluxe box set person. Keefe has personally seen my record collection. I have one, which was Injustice for All, the Super Mega set, because I wanted the live version, the live concert from Injustice for All on vinyl, the Seattle 90s show. And I don't have any other Metallica ones, to give you an idea. And you can get them for like $100, and I don't have any of them. I got that for 160, 180, something like that. Anyway, the other bit of news, another good news, some Phoenix Rising from the Ashes, Power Trip is returning. They're going to come back, do a tour, and hopefully we'll get some other cool stuff. NPR is reporting on that one. So some good stuff. There's some older stuff, some new stuff. It's a good day.
Not 100% sure. Overall, I'm typically like everybody's entitled to come back, even without key members. Riley Gale, rest in power forever, is so intrinsic to Power Trip. And the guy they have, Seth, from the band Fugitive, which includes members of Power Trip and Creeping Death, they picked a good guy. He's like a brother to Riley. He's got the same politics as Riley. He's a similar type of vocalist to Riley, can handle the material. I'm not 100% sure about how I feel. I'm sure ultimately I would love to see this. They are going to announce more shows. It's still hard for me, but like ultimately I'm not disrespecting their choice to move forward. Also, Def Leppard previous Glacially Musical podcast subject, which I will link in the description because it's worth going back and checking out if you've enjoyed these.
We did?
We did, didn't we? We did all of Def Leppard, didn't we? I thought we did.
Maybe we should.
I thought we did. I would say I also don't need that. I love Pyromania. It's easily the second best Def Leppard record, arguably the best Def Leppard record, but surely the second best at the worst. And I don't need outtakes and other versions of Rock Rock Till You Drop and crap like that. I don't need the demos.
I don't need those for anyone. And I just, I don't. If it's an unreleased demo, I probably still don't want it. That's just not my thing. My thing is, and you know, this goes back to, you know, let me quick story here. I know people probably see all these records I'm checking, and I mean, they really are real. That really is the life I'm leaving, life I'm living. But there was a time in my life when I was very, very poor, where it would take me 20 minutes to pick a 6-pack of beer because I wasn't able to afford another one for 2 weeks, or where I spent 3 hours trying to decide whether or not I was going to buy my favorite Roger Waters record on vinyl. It was a $50 record. I was going to spend 15 of my own dollars and I had a gift card because I could get 4 other records for the same price that I spent. And, you know, it's one of my coworkers made fun of me saying, you know, we were talking about things. She goes, oh, I know you don't eat or drink anything cheap. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I eat all kinds of cheap stuff. But it just goes back to when my choice paralysis was so big because it was, you know, if I made a poor choice, it'd be so terrible. That the demo stuff, no, not interested. The outtake stuff, definitely not interested. And if a song wasn't good enough to make your record, it's probably not a good song, especially if it's the Gene Simmons $3,000 Vault box set.
Nobody needs that. Nobody wanted it. Nobody bought it. That GNR like $700 box set for Appetite, I was thinking about it. And I know somebody at that record label. I don't know. I am a completist, and I do like fancy, ridiculous things.
Give up on your completism. Your collection gets bigger. I know.
It's true. It's true. By the way, whatever that is behind, is that a guitar case behind you? It is really distracting me in a good way. No, nothing, Nick? Nicholas? Nick? Hello?
That is my Gibson Les Paul. You can see it.
Oh, all right. I was like, what? That case is never in that spot. I didn't know why it is. Were you playing it?
No.
Oh, my God. That's zip up.
Sorry. I keep saying I'm going to start playing again, and I don't.
I don't.
Well, since we moved, I don't even have a really spot to do it.
Well, you're in the spot to do it. I would sit on that couch and play guitar if I could.
This room is a little small, but anyway.
I don't think so.
You live in San Francisco. I live in the Midwest.
My whole house is the size of that room. So really,
except we have very different opinions on what is and what is not.
Fair enough. News check, real quick. We're gonna put off the Record Store Day rundown for one more week because I just don't have it in me today. I'd rather save that energy for Slayer. More Slayer. Speaking of Slayer and Slayer reunions and other reunions, Slayer has announced another show. They, in addition to the two festivals, they have announced they are participating in Aftershock Sacramento, right in my backyard. Aftershock has now moved another weekend forward as all these festivals are now competing with each other in September and October. I wonder if that means Power Trip is going to come back again. I doubt it highly because it was probably a failure. But Slayer is on the top of the bill along with Slipknot and Motley Crue and Five Finger Death Punch and over Pantera on the same day as Pantera. But imagine seeing Pantera and Slayer back to back. It's pretty great. Oh, and Maiden. That's it. Maiden is also at the top of the bill.
I can't imagine seeing those three bands back to back, and in fact I don't want to.
Not quite back to back. Maiden's on a different day, but yeah.
Okay, because if it were back to back to back, I would explode.
Yeah, so just the highlights of just really quick, right? The Thursday is Slayer, Pantera, Till Lindemann solo, Ministry, Filter, so that tour, Hailstorm, Cypress Hill, Seven Dust, Drain, the hardcore band that I showed the vinyl check last week. Drug Church, great band. Biohazard, and a bunch of other bands. I think Insane Clown Posse also. Day 2, Friday, Slipknot, Five Finger Death Punch, Evanescence, Rise Against, Dropkick Murphys, Architects, very rare for them to play America. Metalcore, one of the best metalcore bands in the world. Instead of System of a Down, Darren Malkanian's Scars on Broadway is back, which means probably no System this year.
Good record.
Good band, yeah, very good band. Code Orange, Bayside, killer pop punk band. Saturday, Iron Maiden, Breaking Benjamin, Anthrax, Judas Priest, right before Maiden, Stained, Clutch, Cold Chamber, Lorna Shore,
Body Count. I can only get so erect.
Tech Nine, you can only get so hard at once. And Sunday, which is kind of disappointing, Motley Crue, a band with a bunch of homophobes, another band of homophobes and anti-abortion foes, Disturbed, Seether, Flogging Molly, Pup, which is a decent band, Tom Morello solo because No More Rage Against the Machine, Shadows Fall, Fear Factory, Anthrax is in there, Hailstorm is in there, Rise Against is in there, Stained, another weirdo band I used to love, I don't anymore because politics. What a lineup. Fantastic. Maybe one of their best lineups ever. And they've had Metallica and that. Guns N' Roses. Yeah, it's a really great lineup, and it is in my backyard. I have to make the decision. We'll see. And then, since we're skipping the other news, I did want to talk very briefly about Sepultura. So we had the revelatory, shocking news that on the eve of launching their farewell year-and-a-half, two-year tour, Eloy Casagrande, who has been in Sepultura like 13 years, had quit the band a month ago, and they just announced it. Now, there's rampant speculation that Eloy is going to be the new drummer of Slipknot. Slipknot is also considered going out on tour for this upcoming festivals and 25th anniversary of their debut album, Tour Dates, with no drummer and just playing to tape. to auto, like playing to Joey Jordison's tracks on tape. I think it's a horrible idea, especially to play at a festival where you have in-ear monitors and there's delay and echo. What you hear on stage is not in real time to what the fans hear. Disastrous, potentially. So I think they're going to pick Eloy to be their permanent new drummer to replace Jay Weinberg. Jay Weinberg is playing with Infectious Grooves. The new drummer for Sepultura is Grayson Newcratum, who was in Suicidal. And I think that means Jay Weinberg is going to end up in Suicidal, because there's no way Grayson, who is incredible, I saw him twice last year and three or four times the last year and a half, there's no way he can be in both bands at the same time who are playing in different parts of the world. Maybe he could do double duty at a festival, but I can't see it. So
you said double duty.
I did say double duty. D-U-D. D-U, whatever. last bit of news. So I'm just like, I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but just wildly shocking that Eloy. I mean, like, I don't blame Eloy. Sepultura is winding down and going to disband, and Slipknot is a payday. He's great, and he'll be a great addition to that band, but it's a huge payday for him, a huge upgrade, right?
No, I mean, no strong thoughts. If you are, you know, one of the things I've talked about in this podcast and the Department of Antiquities with Duncan, you have players, you know, like Billy Joel, who we did Billy Joel's heavy metal record, which, yes, that is a thing. It does exist. And he was a minor league player that worked up to the major leagues. And that happens. You know, sometimes you have major league bands that just need to have somebody to come in. And sometimes, you know, it is what it is. And if somebody is going to, you know, him joining Slipknot for a year, 2 years, even if it's just that, that's going to really take care of him for a long time. And he can then focus on what he wants to do. And that's an amazing thing.
I'm going to take this opportunity to speak directly into the microphone in my NPR voice and go on the public record that I'm a little disappointed, as the number one Billy Joel fan in the entire world, that I was not consulted for that episode of Department of Metal Antiquities. I rest my case.
I'm sorry. It was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing.
What a spur-of-the-moment choice that is, though. Like, wow.
It wasn't that spur-of-the-moment.
Poor Duncan. Poor Duncan. Did you have it on vinyl? I could have guessed. He's probably not a Billy Joel fan in the first place.
But it's nothing like Billy Joel. Anyway.
No.
I spoiler alert. I was Spinnet. Duncan was Bennett. I did not have it on vinyl when we started the podcast episode, but I had already purchased it by the end of it. Unfortunately, I had to buy one of the ridiculous repressings, because the original pressings with the original cover with them in armor in front of meat, literal meat, is like $150 because it's so rare. But they kept re-releasing it in the like Pink Floyd's original label Harvest kept re-releasing early stuff. This record kept getting re-released in the 80s, calling it Attila featuring Billy Joel, except Attila was like the same, was embossed in the same color as the label, and then Billy Joel was real big. So the one I got is called Billy Joel California Flash. And it's like a watercolor painting of him from Piano Man as the cover, not him with the handlebar mustache and the bouffant 80s hair rock, because it was $150 cheaper. Music's music. Same music, though. So
Yeah. Same. I actually like that record quite a bit also.
I loved it.
I love Billy Joel, and I wish he would kind of like it. I hope he has a new song out. That's fantastic. Nick didn't like it or care. But he has a new song, his first new song in 17 years. It is terrific. And I just to fuck with people, I wish that he would just for the last thing he's ever going to do, I'm retired, I'm never playing another show, and like re-record Attila with the band he has now. That would be so sick. I don't think
What I loved about Attila, and this will be the last thing I say, is it reminded me very much of a modern musician that I absolutely love named James Legg. The difference is James Legg is blues and soul. But it's very, the way it comes out very heavy and almost metal. He plays piano. He plays an electric Fender Rhodes piano, not a keyboard, but an actual piano rather than the Hammond organ. But they both do the bass thing, which is awesome. Anyway, it is my turn to lead, I believe. So if you are ready to dance, give me your hand, or is there something else?
I had another news thing, but it's not that important. You go ahead, buddy.
Okay. All righty. So we are getting into Slayer. I would say the first two records of Slayer are, we're discussing a band, and I'm going to get into my NPR voice. The first two records of Slayer were groundbreaking, amazing steps taken in a fledgling genre. What we are now getting into is the classic era of the band, an era of which, if you have ever seen Slayer live, you've heard half of this album played live. Okay, this is pointless. I'm not doing that anymore. But before we get to the recording of the record.
Oh, man, that's great. I can't stop laughing over here. Go ahead.
I didn't think it was that funny, but I appreciate that. So before we get to the actual recording of this album, before we start discussing that and who starts producing that, because I've got a great confluence on that I want to discuss. Brian Slagle realizes that his label, his fledgling label, Metal Blade Records, cannot do Slayer justice. He doesn't have the funds. Metal Blade in 1984, 1985 is not Metal Blade 2024. Metal Blade 2024 is a prestigious heritage metal label, one of the very first extreme metal record labels. Launched Metallica, launched Slayer, launched Gwar, and more.
Cannibal Corpse,
yeah.
Armored Saint.
Correct. However, that time, they had 18, they didn't even give an advance to record the first Slayer record. Slayer had to pay to record Slayer's first record. To give you an idea of what kind of a label they were. So, he comes to the conclusion he is going to go straight up Mr. White with the Oneaters Wonders. It was confusing. Because he realizes he needs to sell them. Actually, no, Mr. White is the one that bought them. I forget who sold them.
I thought you were going to talk about Breaking Bad and Walter White. He went straight to selling Blue Meth in the greater Los Angeles area to finance the record. I'm the one who knocks and records metal records.
I apologize. I did not watch Breaking Bad.
God damn it.
I'm sorry. I don't watch a whole lot of television unless I can binge it. And then I also get bored. Anyway, not the point. We need to do a TV episode where we just discuss this crap.
And if we get on DX Ferris to talk about Slayer, we could do a movie episode because he also wrote a book on Goodfellas. He wrote the book on Goodfellas.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Goonies, but I need to read that book too.
I love Goonies.
He needs to write one on Goonies. I'll read that. Anyway.
Hey, you guys.
Stop it. References are fun, but okay. Serenity now. A cat came in. I'm sorry. He picked the lock. So Brian Slagle realizes that it's time to sell off Slayer. And he actually interviews quite a bit of labels. Please put the shark away. I am going to laugh at the shark. And he ends up, and this is where it gets weird, having an amazing discussion with Rick Rubin. Now, 1986, Rick Rubin has done what?
E-Drop! The Beastie Boys.
And what else?
Run DMC.
There you go. So, not precisely metal, although Kerry King does appear. No, it was Rick Rubin in a Slayer t-shirt appears in the Fight for Your Right party. And Kerry King ends up appearing on No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
They're in the video. You just don't see them. Apparently, Kerry and Tom are in the video somewhere.
Okay.
According to Adam Dubin, who directed that music video. And later on, A Year in the Life of Metallica and many other things. Murder in the Front Row and other things.
And Year and a Half, quite good. If you like thrash metal, you've probably already seen them. So we're just preaching to the choir here. He said he had trepidation about selling off Slayer to a hip hop label. At that particular time, they were still Def Jam Recordings. They had yet to become Def American, or of course American Recordings, as they're known today. I believe American Recordings was after he and Russell Simmons split up. But he said Rick Rubin was the most passionate person he spoke to about Slayer. Which, if you think about that, Rick Rubin was an aspiring DJ, did some DJing with the Beastie Boys. I believe he played a few shows, was a little bit on License to Ill, and probably learned a lot of his trade from Jam Master Jay. But that's an amazing thing, because at this time, And in the 80s especially, segregation in the entertainment was a real thing. Yes, I know I am a cishet white male full of privilege. So I'm not trying to preach or anything, but it's just, I lived through that era. 48 Hours was an amazing movie in Trading Places, groundbreaking movies, because they featured a white and black protagonist. That was almost unheard of. That was the Amos and Andy, which we hadn't seen in decades. So for him to bridge that gap between these two genres, you know, hip hop at that time, apart from the Beastie Boys, was a very not white genre. And heavy metal, especially extreme metal to this day, is still a very white space. Getting not as white, but still a very white space. And that is why Brian Slagle has trepidation. However, in the end, he sells them to Dave Lombardo meets with him. They come up to Seattle. Rick Rubin says there have never been good photos taken of the band. They do a photo shoot and continue to use those photos for years because they did such a great shoot. And that's when the break happens. They, you know, it's Slayer gets sent off to Europe to go do their gap year, which becomes a gap forever. And thank you, Brian Slagle, because you did something amazing. And then what happens? Rick Rubin produces the band. And there's a very big difference between Rick Rubin producing your record on the label he owns and Brian Slagle producing your record on the label he owns. No disrespect to Brian Slagle. He is one of the best talent scouts, bird doggers, finders that heavy metal has ever known. And we owe him debts far greater than we could ever repay. If I ever meet him, I will give him a foot massage, even if Marcellus Wallace will shoot me when I'm done. Worth it. Thoughts?
Perfect as usual, my friend. You are the setter-upper of all time. Vince Coleman would be jealous of you. You know, I've met Brian, and he's a lovely fellow. And I look forward to... I've interviewed him. I would love to interview him for this show. I'd love to interview him again and just in general.
I would like to thank him and give him a foot massage.
His books are invaluable resources for metal history. I am really hoping I can go to Vegas in 2 months and go to the Metal Blade Museum that is officially now open every day.
Oh, I'm going to Vegas in August.
With tours by Brian. You could get to meet him if you pay for a tour. You got to get in advance. Well in advance, they sell out. And they're limited to like 10 people max.
Can I hug him?
He might let you hug him. He's a huge hockey fan, as you know.
But probably not second base.
I mean, I don't know that he's partnered up. He might appreciate a grope. I don't know if that's inappropriate.
Lawyer wife would be with me, and I mean, no. I can't. I mean, foot massage I think I could do, but I think he would have to pay me for it, even if it's like a dollar, you know, like Trading Places, the bet.
There's a big difference between a foot massage and the holiest of holies.
Oh, look, it ain't the same ballpark, it ain't the same league, it ain't the same fucking sport.
Well done. Man, we probably quote Tarantino way too much on this show. He's,
I'm feeling a little tired myself. I could use a foot massage right about now. What do you think? Did I take my shoes off?
Anyway. Sorry. That's okay. I think what the most interesting thing is, two things. Later on, after this experience and Slayer explodes, Metal Blade ends up making major label distribution deals that essentially a few years earlier would have supported this record without a problem. Slayer's early, late 80s, early 90s releases all have Atlantic Records as an imprint. In Europe, some of them are on Warner Brothers. So that is the equivalent of Def Jam, which has ended up, I believe they were bought by Geffen. Which doesn't exist anymore either, but Geffen is now also part of Universal and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, it leads future Metal Blade releases to get major label distribution that could have aided this record, but just a couple years too soon. Also, because they chose Rick, this changes the course of metal production history because Rick is not a typical producer, A. He's really more of like a do this, don't do that. My sonic opinion of that is this. his encyclopedic knowledge of music. He's not a doesn't know music theory, cannot play an instrument, cannot move the dials himself. He may pretend to. He really doesn't. He said so much recently.
Ozzy Osbourne discussed Rick Rubin producing 13, I believe it was. And he's like, he would show up like half a day every week.
Yeah, Iommi was like, I don't know what we paid that guy like $1 billion for. Why? Why didn't we keep that money and do it ourselves? I've produced plenty of records.
But mind you, this is the same. Well, I mean, Iommi's records that he produced are the ones he produced, and we don't want to talk about those.
Well, but I'm just saying, though, like, Rick Rubin's body of work in every genre he's worked in, Chili Peppers, Slayer, just, you know, Metallica, it's not beyond reproach. His stuff's just untouchable. But
that is actually the confluence I wanted to discuss, because we have two entities meeting in the middle, Rick Rubin and Slayer.
Because Rick Rubin was not a metal, he did consult with Glenn Friedman, that was introduced by Brian to Glenn. Glenn is the guy who produced the very first Suicidal record, and was friends with Slayer. He didn't work on their stuff. He was like a consultant, and he'd worked on many pinnacle early hardcore band records and early thrash metal records. And Glenn and Rick apparently compared notes about production and what a metal record needs and maybe what Slayer was lacking. And we discussed Hell Awaits being Show No Mercy, Hell Awaits, what a production and a progression those were. But the production was always lacking. And Rain and Blood is one of the best sound. It's not just the best Slayer record. It's not just maybe one of the best records ever. Maybe the best thrash record ever. We're going to save that for the end.
It is.
It probably is, but we'll talk about it. Another record came out the same time that might a little bit before this that might be better, but it's the first time that actually the complexity of Slayer songs shines through because the production allowed for it. And it was no mud in the guitars. All the drums were mic'd and tuned and recorded beautifully. Tom's bass, you hear the bass, all the things. And because Rick is not a metal guy at first, at heart. Obviously now you would say he's certainly qualified. But at that moment, this was new to him. And because it was new to him, it helped him produce this record the way it came out, I believe. You tell me your thoughts.
It's one of the rare times in this world where he didn't know the rules in order to first... He didn't first know the rules in order to break the rules. He broke the rules perfectly. His production is unlike any metal record that leads up to it. You know, we did an Iron Maiden run, and Iron Maiden never sounded this good. And Iron Maiden was on a major label. Metallica doesn't sound this good until the 90s. Megadeth never sounds this good. The wonderful, perfect, natural reverb gives the double bass extra power. You know, you get to hear that galloping feel on the guitars, and I don't know how much input he had on the music itself, probably very little, because he's just not that guy. But what he is able to do, he is able to say, this is wrong, this is right, go this way, you should probably go left on this one instead of going right. And he coaxes out great records. For the most part, whenever he produces a band, he levels them up. I feel like he got Metallica back on track. Unfortunately, that victory is what doomed Black Sabbath, because he tried doing the exact same approach to Black Sabbath as he had for Metallica, whereas Black Sabbath did not want to go back to an earlier time and reboot. They just wanted to do what they were doing. And then on top of that, Tony Iommi hated the fact that Rick Rubin was telling him how to be Tony Iommi.
That's what Rick does the best. He gets you back to you. He gets you to be who you're supposed to be, or he thinks you're supposed to be. I love 13 unapologetically, by the way. I don't care. In terms of a final record from that band, I know what band that band should sound like at that age. A lot of people don't like the record. I don't know what they could have done differently or better, unless they had somebody come in and write the songs for them, which a record with Iommi is not going to have. It's not Andrew Watt and Ozzy's current solo records where he's not writing anything, except maybe the vocal
melodies. Oh, come on. Ozzy never wrote anything.
That's just not true. That's just categorically untrue, sir.
We'll fight about that another time. However, another time. The thing that they could have done on 13 to make it better, in Nick's opinion, edit.
band, again, this is the perennial argue, the chicken egg. Does a veteran band allow themselves to say this isn't good enough and self-edit? Most do not.
That's what the producer is for.
And Rick is that producer. That's what he does. I'm going to disagree about, like, he doesn't know music like staves and clefs and notes and sheet music and how to play guitar, piano, or anything. But what Rick does, he is a guy that says, shorten that. You did that riff 16 times, make it 8. Because he knows songs.
That's what I was trying to convey.
Okay, sure. I'm sorry I didn't get it.
That's my fault. I don't always put things. No, it's my fault. I use a lot of euphemisms and analogies, and sometimes the references that happen in my head don't always work. We're driving down the street, me and Wonder Kid, and she asks me, and I say something, and she goes, "Wait, how the hell did you get to that?" So I gave her the 6 degrees of separation in my head from like this thing I heard on the radio to 3 seconds later where I'm talking about something that has 8 degrees of separation. So yes, what I'm saying is he cannot write music. He can shape music. He's the ultimate editor. Unfortunately, on 13, there was very little editing because all those songs were way too long.
By the way, speaking of way too long, did you put on a sweatshirt while I was talking?
Yes, I did.
Are you cold?
Missouri is drunk. Yesterday it was 75.
go Missouri home. You're home drunk.
Yeah, go home, Missouri. You're drunk. Yesterday was 75 degrees, okay? I woke up this morning and it was 22.
What?
Yes, that. So when I tell people we have the worst weather in the world, ask yourself, when is the last time you had a 50-degree swing in 6 hours? In Missouri, we call that spring, summer. Spring, fall, and winter.
That's like Nevada. That's insane, dude.
Yeah, it's like that song, you know, that St. Louis, How Does St. Louis Do It? You know, 105 in the summertime, winter 5 below. That's actually not true. It's 115 in the summer here now. So anyway, where were we? Rick Rubin gets the best out of his charges. When you bring him in, he gives you the rope. And then, that's not fair. He lets you play with your own yarn. And you're knitting a sweater. And then
not a sexual reference.
The hell is wrong with you? Go touch a boob sometime.
I've been touching boobies. I had a visitor from my lady friend visited last week.
Wow.
I touched many boobies. Yeah.
Pervert.
I'm handsome and I'm on YouTube. I do get to score. And then I scored. Ha ha.
Thank you, Beavis. Okay. Wow. I'm going to need more beer. So you knit your shirt, you crochet it. He comes in and he fixes it. He fixes the shirt and he makes it great. That is something the Slayer does not have at this point. Even in this early stage in Rick Rubin's career, he has that ear. He has that ability. And he does not engineer it, thank God. He brings in Andy Wallace to engineer the record. Andy Wallace, who has done such other great things as Juicy Fruit, Run DMC, Raising Hell, The Cult, The Front, New Model Army, The Godfathers, Radioactive Cats. He comes in and does Sepultura in 1991. Engineers Nirvana, Nevermind, Sonic Youth, Helmet, Rage Against the Machine's debut. So basically, he brings in a complete nobody that goes on to nothing.
I think it's unfair to say he was a nobody at that time. He wasn't well known.
Sarcasm.
And people who have worked with Rick, like Greg Fiddleman, now Metallica's primary guy in-house, they end up becoming... Everybody that's worked with Rick goes on to something else. And...
I was trying to be silly.
And he's also produced whole Slayer records by himself later years. So very.
Yeah, and he, I mean, I'm looking at the list of bands he has done, and you have heard of every single one. And I would imagine if you took all of these albums and added up how much, because he is an engineer, a mixer, and a producer. And if you added up how many records these things have sold, he has probably sold 300 million records.
That's awesome. Here's an on-the-air suggestion for a future series. How about we do a series in the future on producers? We do like a month of episodes where we just pick a producer and we talk about their discography and things they've done.
Ooh.
Specific, like really drill down on one guy, one episode, one guy or gal. And we do like maybe five or six or seven or eight.
Do you think we could get Bob Ezrin on the show, or do you think we're not big enough?
We are not big enough to get Bob Ezrin. Neither is Ghost Cult, honestly. And I don't know. If you wanted to, Bob, I was thinking more like Terry Date and Rick Rubin, but Bob Ezrin we should do, and Eddie Kramer we could do. And
Bob Ezrin is great because he's done so many, he's like Rick Rubin. He's done so many different, and our new friend Andy Wallace, he's done so many different kinds of music.
Andy Sneap, Colin Richardson, Sylvia Massey, many, 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 many. Ulrich Wilde, there's many we could go.
I think producers are the underrated talent, and I want to give a hearty congratulations to Steve Brown, who produced the latest Ace Frehley record, which we will get into 3 weeks after you hear this.
I feel like I don't want to just do Ace for a whole episode. I got to be honest with you. I don't. I wouldn't mind doing Ace plus Mick Morris in that same episode. Maybe we do a roundup episode.
All right, Danny Nichols, friend of the show, asked me today when I posted the Mick Mars record, are we doing an episode on it?
We are. That's it.
Okay.
I decided.
It's a double chaser.
I'm also picking the next series, I decided, but we haven't got there yet.
That's fine too.
You think so? You may not like my choices.
Well, you know what? I can get extra salty, boy.
You could. Let's just talk about one last thing and then quickly burn through the track by track. You are critical of this album's length. And I want to say this album, before we jizz all over it anyway, this album is perfect. Did not need to be longer than 29 minutes. It's 28:55 in the original format. The reissue is the one people born after the year 2000 know, because that's the Spotify version, the longer version with Aggressive Perfector and the remix of Criminally Insane.
Man, they've gotten so much mileage out of Aggressive Perfector.
They really have. They love that song.
It's like, wow, we're going to release an extra long version of something? Oh, shit.
Yeah, let's get a bonus track. Oh, Aggressive Perfector, do we have a live one? Yes, we do. Let's do that.
All right, do we have an outtake? What Aggressive Perfector recording have we not used?
Tom Araya, different vocal mix version. I want to just say, like, this is the moment. Like, you know, Metallica's already had a modicum of success, moved over to Elektra Records. We didn't do this, but really quickly, here's another future idea. 1986, maybe the best year ever in metal for releases? Arguable. Discuss later on. In the same year, right, you have P-Cells, Master of Puppets, which comes out a few months before this, and Rain and Blood, and that's just those three. Not to mention a gaggle of other incredible metal records and heavy metal records and thrash metal records.
I don't think most of our listeners know those albums, so that'd be a good series to do.
Well, I mean, not a series, an episode on like the best year in metal, 91, 93, 94. We're at the 30th anniversary of 94, and I can rattle off 10 great records off the top of my head.
Do a series of a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year series.
I could. And I think there's, you know, kind of a recurring series on ghostcultmag.com, which is Classic Albums Revisited, which I've had you write some. I may have you write some more. And again, by the way, if you're listening to this, also Nick has reviewed the Clouds Taste Satanic album for Ghost Cult, and that's going to be on the site tomorrow. Maybe tonight. I don't know. And you've been critical of the length of this album. It's too short. It's not a whole album. You throw a dig out there right at the top to piss me off. I know what you do. You like to trigger me. That's what you do. You like to trigger me. This record is the perfect length because Slayer's goal on this record was to be faster and more brutal and more complex on the guitar than every other band in existence. And they did it. And the songs, the first track of the album is too long. Like a touch. I mean, I say Angel of Death is too long. It's 4:51 with the intro and the outro. It's not too long, but it's the longest song on here. It's meant to be a speed metal record. These songs are more punk, as much to punk as thrash metal. This is an astounding record, and I don't think it's too short. I think it's just right. I know you don't agree.
See,
let's fight.
I have a lot of things, right? If A, then B. Discuss this. I've discussed these kinds of things with my therapist in the past. And if it's an album, it is 30 minutes minimum. That has been my limit. But over the years, I've joked about the length of this album. Yes, I do think it should be longer. They could have done one more track. You throw one more track on here, and Nick shuts his filthy hole about this forever. Instead, I use this album as the limit of the shortest an album, an LP can be, the shortest LP of all time. One Rain in Blood is 28 minutes, 55 seconds. Yes, I would like a little bit more. And I, as a former very poor person, have issues with short records. That is, it is a trigger for me, because am I going to buy your 28 minute record? Because I actually bought this album on vinyl, which I'll check later forever ago. By the time I check it, everybody's going to forget I even said this. And I didn't buy this album on vinyl for so long because it's so short. That is the honest to God truth. Whereas I already have other Slayer records, which are far longer. That we'll get to. But yes, if you pay for an album, you're paying for time. I spent about $1 a minute on this record, and I feel like that's just a bad price. It's like a Big Mac for $7.50, man. Come on, man.
It's not how I look at records. It's really not how I judge my records. But you're you, and I'm me. I love you, and I love working with you, and I'm not angry. I'm just, my point of view is some records are just perfect the way they are. This record is perfect the way it is. I can't think of a song to kick off the island. There's one song I like a little less than the other nine, and I'm going to tell you which one it is. But realistically,
the one you like a little bit less, I'm going to guess what it is it's Mine. So when we get to that album, we're going to go, like, I'll lead this, right? Track one, and when it's that one, you say what it is. It's like, this is it. So let's see if we hit it.
Let's try to I mean, we could gush on this for hours. I could talk about this record for 5 hours and never stop. I love this record. This is arguably the greatest record in metal. We're going to get to it in a second.
Yeah, we don't need a money shot this one from top to bottom.
We're at that. Well, we do. We're at the hour mark right now. So let's try to bang a little over it. Let's bang through this track list. I do want to do every song because then you won't know what I have to do
every.
And then we'll do the summary. We've kind of already done the summary, but we'll do the two. We'll just talk about the importance quickly and sum up and go. So like I'm thinking 15 minutes left.
That number. So okay.
Rocket.
Track number one, Angel of Death, probably the most famous Slayer track outside of metal fandom. Not Slayer's best track, in my humble opinion. Your mileage may vary. However, this track I have heard over and over, Slayer or Nazis, Slayer or Nazis, Slayer or Nazis. Because when I saw them at Ozfest, they had Nazis playing on the screen and they had the blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, that's horror. That's them. You know, Jeff Hanneman spoke about that at length, saying, well, I know the name of every general from World War II. Do you? And, you know, just because you write a song about a thing does not mean you are glorifying a thing. Get rid of that Judeo-Christian mentality of a song as glorification. Angel of Death, perfect song, classic, played in every show from the moment they wrote this song to the day they died. And we'll come back in the new track, on the new whatever's going on. Which weirdness is happening there. So we'll talk about that later.
Perfect song, no notes, arguably the best song by them or the second best song by them. You could throw a blanket over it, 1A, 1B, this track, the closing track, title track. Jeff completely composed this. This is the most famous Jeff Riffin song. And it is one of the most important songs ever, spawned all the Slayer clones as much or more than anything they did before this, reset the bar super high. Lombardo's incredible drumming, the power groove breakdown riff, which other bands had a breakdown riff before, but not like the riff that was borrowed by the most famous band ever in hip-hop beside the Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, for She Watched Channel Zero. That's how big a riff it is. Also, you know, not produced by Rick Rubin, but, you know, kind of colleagues, friends. And I do have to say what Slayer does incredibly well, one thing that they do want you to know, is they push the envelope so hard that you have to argue they're not Nazis, because it is very graphic lyrics and very graphic imagery. Whatever they sing about, you have to question them, because it's almost going, it's a little too far. I was raised Jewish. I am fully not religious these days. It was shocking the first time I heard it, but I didn't feel like these guys are glorified. They're just pointing out the grossness of humanity, which I can relate to, and everyone can
relate
to.
They are as Nazi as Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson portrayed a Nazi. Does that make him a Nazi?
I know.
He portrayed it wonderfully.
But
acting. If you don't mind, I'll cut you off, and I'm going to say this, and we'll move on. And I apologize for the cutoff. The greatest thing about music in this world, why music is my favorite art form, is because it encompasses all the other art forms simultaneously, including acting. Genius! And Slayer are, frankly, master thespians. And I don't mean that in a sick way. I mean, like, you don't know. And that's the point. The point is it's supposed to be shocking and awful, because they are singing about something shocking and awful. And speaking about something shocking and awful, track two, Piece by Piece.
This is my song that I don't love. Yeah, what? This is the one for me. Yeah, this is the one that's not my favorite. It's a 10 of 10 record, but this one to me is like a 9.
What?
8.5, if we did such things.
No. Anyway, speaking of shocking and awful, Piece by Piece, here we go. This is the record where Slayer matures. It's not about, you know, satanic panic imagery, which they had been up to this point. Now Slayer is singing about real world atrocity. They have become what Carcass becomes later. They have become what NWA becomes later, reality metal instead of reality rap. And when you sing about real things, it's way more shocking and it's way more awful. Love this song.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a great song, but it's just, to me, pales a little bit by comparison to the rest of the album. It is, unsurprisingly, the only song written completely by Carrie on the record. Interesting, no credits for Araya or Lombardo still. Araya, I think, had a couple of writing credits on Hell Awaits. None for Lombardo. You're just the drummer, I guess. I guess his iconic drumming that no one else could do for the whole 80s, except for maybe Gene Hoglan.
I don't like any drummers because they're damn weirdos. But I will say this. Why every drummer in the world doesn't get a writing credit on every song, I'll never understand.
So you can play drums. I don't get it.
Correct.
Great track, just not my favorite. That's all.
Fair enough. All right, moving on to Necrophobic. Again, we are delving into the deepest recesses of the psyche, the recesses that people don't want to admit exist. And they are able to go in there and really make it real. And it's real. And great sound, great everything. I mean, there's no point in repeating that track by track by track, because all of them are that way.
Shockingly, this is the third or fourth song in Slayer's history up to this point about necrophilia.
They got a type. They
definitely have a type. They're shallow. I will also say, not necessarily, this song's got a tremendous hardcore influence from Jeff and a more heavy metal influence from Kerry. But I will say that we didn't talk about it yet. The lead guitar style that Slayer is known for really comes out, is really formed fully on this record. And you really, when one of them breaks for a solo, that nonsensical, what could be gibberish, could be jazz, could be avant-garde, definitely jarring, definitely meant to jar you out of your senses, not a blues-based pentatonics. It's just like wild, uncontrollable noise. To quote the guitar player in my band in the late 90s, in my thrash band, he was like, are they even playing the solo to the right song? Like, maybe they went to cut a solo and they weren't hearing it back. It's possible. So Necrophobic is killer, 1:40, tight and great.
I would agree with that. Next, we move on into Altar of Sacrifice. Now we are getting a little bit back into the Satanic Panic, but done in a non-silly way. You know, the Antichrist, great song in on Decade of Aggression, where it doesn't sound silly. Kind of a bad song on Show No Mercy, where it sounds silly. When we are doing this, we are singing, I feel it's more along the lines of the scene from Young Sherlock Holmes rather than The Omen. But again, you know, Slayer has finally, they have left the pupil stage and they have entered into, you know, they have become, when you say Slayer, this is the first Slayer record. This is when they have found themselves completely.
I don't disagree with that. I think that we were seeing evidence of it before, but this is when it really, you know, completely culminates. But I don't think that's completely accurate to say this is when they did it, because they were already doing it on the last record. They just sound the best now. You couldn't tell. Now everything is better. The riffs are better. The songwriting is better. Lyrics are better. Tom is better. Everybody's better. And the recording is doing justice to the music they made. So I really don't fully agree.
Okay. That's fair.
Great song, though. Great song.
Next track, Jesus Saves. Whenever I see anybody spray paint that onto a manhole cover, I immediately start screaming Slayer lyrics, because Slayer.
God listens to Slayer. This might be the third best song on this whole album. It is incredible. I never not love hearing it live. King lyrics.
Pretty damn good.
He really hates. So show me on the doll where the priest hurt you, Kerry, because this dude hates Christianity more than life hates humanity. And great song all the way, a little under 3 minutes. Again, perfect, no notes.
Fair enough. Shall we flip the record and go into track six, Criminally Insane? Again, here we have Slayer singing about things that happen. And, you know, I wish I could say that America was a safe place. It's largely safe if you don't do drugs and you don't close down the bars, but largely is not completely. And I think a big part of why songs like this get such a reaction from certain sides of the country that feel like they have sunburnt skin all the time, that, you know, like, you know, behind me there, is because they don't want to hear about that. There is a segment of the population that wants to pretend that everything in this country is wonderful and perfection and awesome and everything's fine. It's never fine. I mean, there's always, to quote Martin Luther King, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That is why it is the state v. defendant. And when you want to believe that America is the greatest place in the world where dreams come true and, you know, the streets taste like ice cream, when you hear these songs, it reminds you that you're lying to yourself. And there is nothing more painful than having your awfulness reflected back on you. And that's what this is.
Very fair. Really no notes on the song itself, but a fun fact about this banger of a song. On the 2002 album Primitive by Soulfly, there's a song called Terrorist, which sounds very old school 80s thrash. And Max Cavalera invited Tom Araya to sing a lyric from Criminally Insane, Night Will Come and I Will Follow, For My Victims Know Tomorrow, to which then Max answers call and response style, Only I Guide My Inner Self, from Inner Self by Sepultura. So I like the little callback. Go back and check that record out. A lot of guest stars. New metal, thrash metal, a little hardcore. Not a bad record. Primitive.
Anybody want to listen to Chaos AD all of a sudden?
Oh, all the time.
I need that album still.
I hate to self-promote as usual, but my newest interview with Max Cavalera to discuss his band Go Ahead and Die with his son ran this week.
Very cool. Moving on to track seven, my least favorite song on the record, Reborn. No notes, no recollection of the song. So
it's pretty much a banger. It's I mean, it's not as memorable lyrically. I would say probably a little bit, but also around the piece by piece level. Maybe this is an 8, that's an 8. And but yeah, it's not a terrible song by any stretch on an album of 10s, and also following Altar of Sacrifice, Jesus Saves and Criminally Insane, the next something next would be underwhelming. By the way, how many bands are named after tracks on this album?
Many. A lot. I'm just going to say track 7. It shouldn't be track 7. It should be track 9 because it's playing right field.
Yikes. Good one.
Thank you. Moving on to... what?
I understood that reference.
Baseball's the thing.
Monkeys that fly.
Okay. Moving on to Epidemic. You know what? We're in the soft underbelly of the record. But the weird thing about this album, well, not weird, but the soft underbelly of this record, it just feels like each song is a new movement to another song. You know, we're losing a little bit, and this is, you know, Slayer defined. We're losing a little bit. We're not at artistic Slayer. We're not at differentiated Slayer yet. They still grow and change as musicians and writers down the road. We're still kind of an AC/DC Slayer, where a lot of it sounds samey. And Reborn, Epidemic, and even a little bit of Postmortem is a little samey.
Again, that's what they were going for. So I'm going to counterpoint that to say that Epidemic is actually killer. Again, this is what they were going for. Nobody sounded like this. Today, we are ruined by a million bands that sound like these three songs. And that's their whole aesthetic. And this is a small facet of Slayer's entire ethos. So this is just a small part of what they do. And so I know. Epidemic is actually a great song.
Everything, I'm not saying it isn't. Everything you said is absolutely 100% accurate. Because when we go back in 2024 to 1986, we cannot disallow, and ignore all the 1,800, 48, and 62 million copies of this record that you and I have both heard over a decade of reviewing music.
By the way, I got to chime in. There's a great interview with Guitar World in the early 90s for the Clash of the Titans tour, where there's a conversation with Jeff and Kerry, and they interviewed Dave Mustaine, and they interviewed Scott Ian, and they were talking about, you know, we have to talk about all these Slayer babies the way there was the Metallica babies. And Kerry was like, I didn't make no Slayer babies. I didn't make any Slayer babies. That's somebody else. And I was like, you might want to let that cat out of the room while I'm talking. But there's now. But
I can't. I'm sorry.
Anyway.
One of my cats picked the lock.
It's got some sharp claws. Which one is it? Now I need to know.
Which one is here or which one picked the lock?
Whichever you, I mean, you wouldn't, how would you know who picked the lock unless you were outside when they were doing it?
Because I watched him come in.
But that doesn't mean he picked the lock. Another cat could have.
The smartest one picked the lock.
Which one?
Goose.
All right. Fair. Postmortem is great. And all Jeff lyrics and music. This guy gave us so much just in these 29 minutes, boy. Most of this record is Jeff's record, but I think of this as a Jeff record. There are Jeff records and there are Kerry records. Okay. South of Heaven is a Kerry record. This is a Jeff record.
Truth time. Do we need to discuss Raining Blood?
I mean, a little. It's the best Slayer song, period, and it might be the best metal song ever.
Not only is it the money shot of this record, when they reunited with Dave, it had a money shot. At the end of the Still Raining DVD, they dropped thousands of gallons of blood, and Jeff missed.
Apparently, it sounded terrible live, and when they went in to make the record, they went in and overdubbed the guitar parts because it was so wet.
Yeah, I don't doubt that.
It sounded like crap because Like, I look visually amazing.
Stunning.
And War at the Warfield is what I believe you're talking about.
No, there was a DVD called Still Raining.
Okay. Well, the performance was here in San Francisco at the Warfield.
Yeah, War at the Warfield. No, that was earlier. That was in the 90s. That,
No, definitely a little later. But okay, we can debate that later. Rain and Blood rules. copied. Every band has tried to play that opening. How many shows have you been to where, I mean, like, Mr. Bungle is on tour, Dave Lombardo's the drummer, and every show they play the beginning of Rain and Blood as, like, literally for 2 minutes. Oh, hey, look who's here. You should unmute yourself so people can see.
This is Roy.
That's the new boy. New boy, yes. Roy. Yes.
He is.
Is this Roy's first appearance on the show? Careful.
I got him. He's fine. Come here, buddy. I mean, yes, like, this is Roy's first appearance on the show.
Roy's going to cut your throat in a second.
No, he's fine. Boop. Bye, Roy. Yes, I mean, okay, and you're right. War at the Warfield was 2003. I apologize. You are muted.
Is Rain and Blood the best? Raining Blood the best thrash metal song ever?
Yes.
Is Rain and Blood the best thrash metal record ever?
Yes.
I would say it's 1 and 1A. To me, it's Master of Puppets and then Rain and Blood, but that's me.
Here's why. Okay. Master of Puppets is a better record, and I will take Master of Puppets every day over Rain and Blood. However, Master of Puppets is not a pure thrash record. As you said earlier, Slayer came in, wanted to hit you hard, kick you in the dick, and then piss on you while Jeff Hanneman solos and takes a dump on your face. That's it. Whereas Metallica wants to come in and show you, look at our artistic abilities, our dynamic qualities, our wonderful things. I'm not saying A is better than B, but Metallica did not want to make a thrash record. And I would actually make the argument by the time they got to Master of Puppets, they were no longer a purely thrash band. They had moved into progressive metal a la Iron Maiden.
I guess. I don't think that's until the next record, but whatever. I'm going to give my final 30-second wrap-up. You please then wrap up in 1 minute or less, and let's get out of here because we're almost at an hour and a half. Arguably the best record ever in the genre. Clearly set the bar so high, endlessly imitated, never really duplicated by anyone. Probably a good thing that they didn't try to redo it again. And became their own, like, literally, this is the most clearly identifiable, unique, and special album the band has ever done. There are several other great ones that are right alongside of it. This is their first 10 of 10. I don't think any previous, there's some high ones, there's some good songwriting, there's the basis of the genre that live on these earlier records. This is the most complete they will ever be. Perhaps not as diverse as Metallica ever, not as diverse as Megadeth, certainly not as diverse as Anthrax, but just what they set out to do and what they accomplished, tens across the board for this.
There is nothing I can really add to that. Slayer decided they were going to come in and be awesome, did that. It is a 10 of 10 record, even with a minor complaint of that I think it's a bit too short. However, it's just a bit. And that's all I got this week. Who takes us out? Is it you or is it me?
I think it's me. You have been listening to the Glacially Musical Podcast. I am your co-host, Ghost Cult Keefe at ghostcultmag.com, at ghostcultkeefe at ghostcultmag.com, on all your socials. Check us out every day for news, reviews, interviews, the whole yada, yada, yada. You know Nicholas, Glacially Musical, Glacially_musical at Nick_no_C on X, formerly Twitter, for vinyl porn and glacially musical related things and slice of life of Nick things, a lot of meat, steak photos and things like that, and pasta faces and, you know, jogging updates now, walking updates. You know, we really love this. If you've actually listened to this entire thing, you are either a diehard Slayer psychopath or a real one and a completist. So thank you for listening to this entire thing.
Either way, our people.
Yeah, you are our people. You are our tribe. To also quote Max Cavalera. And as we like to say every week in this juncture of the show, you've been listening to the Glacially Musical Podcast. It does not play in Peoria. Slayer has played in Peoria many times, including April 17, 1999, when, guess what? They closed with Angel of Death and Raining Blood in that order.
Like every other show.